Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to a healthy and productive new year, and welcoming you as well to the January 8th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the 2nd, 4th, and every other 5th Wednesday, and one of which will be coming up at the end of January. To start off my 14th year on KZYX, I'm going to be speaking at 20 minutes past the hour with Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois at Champaign, about how that very subject, international law, together with our vanishing civil liberties, will fare in 2014 under the administration of President Obama. So stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, let's take a look at what has been largely missing from the news and the War and Peace Report since my last program, with a focus on Iran, which the Israel lobby and those in Congress and the media who serve it envision as America's next target to be destroyed. When we last spoke, President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry had been pleading with Congress not to pass any new sanctions legislation that might cause a breakdown in the discussion with Iran about curtailing its nuclear program. To pass new sanctions on top of those in place, they said, would lead to Tehran pulling out of its negotiations with the P5 nations plus Germany, not to mention violating an agreement that U.S. negotiators made with Iran as a prerequisite to holding the current talks. Pushing against the White House has been Israel's forward base on U.S. soil, AIPAC, its registered domestic lobby, along with the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the lobbying arm of 156 Jewish federations across the country. The first slap in the administration's face came on December 19th from 26 senators divided equally, AIPAC style, among Democrats and Republicans. They put their names on Senate Bill 1881, the quote-unquote Nuclear Weapon-Free Iran Act, which had been initiated by Cuban-born New Jersey Democrat Robert Menendez and Illinois Republican Mark Kirk, two of the top recipients of pro-Israel campaign funds. Signatories included the entire Democratic Senate delegations from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, the Senate's two leading war hawks, Lindsey Graham and John McCain, and Menendez's fellow Cubans, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, both of whom expect to be competing for the Republican nomination in 2016, and the contributions from well-heeled Israel supporters that will be needed to move their campaigns along. The legislation, not surprisingly, goes beyond current U.S. policy as well as that of its European allies that are part of the negotiations with Iran. The differences start with one, quote, the government of Iran, it says, must not be allowed to develop or maintain nuclear weapon capabilities, and two, all instruments of power and influence of the United States should remain on the table to prevent the government of Iran from developing nuclear weapon capabilities, end quote. This is, of course, the Israeli government position, not Washington's or its allies, which is that simply Iran should not be allowed to build a nuclear weapon, the capability to build one being a more subjective criteria. Number three, citing the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty that went into force in 1970, the bill declares that, quote, the government of Iran does not have an absolute or inherent right to enrichment and reprocessing capabilities and technologies, end quote. The nicest thing one can say for those who initiated and those who are sponsoring this bill is that they never bothered to read the treaty, which clearly states under Article 4, quote, nothing in this treaty shall be interpreted as affecting the inalienable right of all the parties to the treaty to develop research, production, and use nuclear energy for peaceful purposes without discrimination and in conformity with Articles 1 and 2 of this treaty. Those articles refer to agreement by nuclear states not to assist non-nuclear states in building nuclear weapons, and by non-nuclear states, such as Iran, not to receive or solicit or attempt to build its own nuclear weapons. No proof has yet emerged, despite all the allegations, that Iran has tried to do either, while Israel, whose name is never mentioned in this discussion and which has never signed the treaty, has done both. It received assistance from France and the U.S., and is estimated to have several hundred nuclear weapons, including some already installed in Israel's nuclear submarines. The Obama administration has conceded Iran's right to nuclear enrichment is valid. Israel and those in Congress who take orders from it and AIPAC do not. The most disturbing language in the resolution comes from its fifth resolve. Quote, if the government of Israel is compelled to take military action in legitimate self-defense against Iran's nuclear weapon program, it states, the United States government should stand with Israel and provide, in accordance with the law of the United States and the constitutional responsibility of Congress, to authorize the use of military force, diplomatic, military, and economic support to the government of Israel in its defense of its territory, people, and existence, end quote. In other words, these senators who have sworn an oath to defend the U.S. Constitution want to place the decision for the United States to go to war in the hands of a foreign government, in this case, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. In response, 10 Democratic Senate committee chairs wrote a letter to Majority Leader Harry Reid, urging him not to allow a vote on the bill. But they were careful not to question the patriotism of their colleagues, their willingness to let Israel push the U.S. into another war, nor the pressure applied by AIPAC on them to do so. The Iranians are cast as the deal-breakers. At this time, as negotiations are ongoing, the letter said, we believe that new sanctions would play into the hands of those in Iran who are most eager to see negotiations fail, end quote. Among its signers were Banking Committee Chair Tim Johnson from South Dakota and California's two senators, Dianne Feinstein, Chair of the Intelligence Committee, and Barbara Boxer, Chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee. By the time the bill was published, it had added 8 additional co-sponsors, and by this Monday, after the Senate had returned from vacation, the total had reached 47. And this morning, I just learned reading the internet, the Jerusalem Post says that the number has now reached 50, which means half the Senate is siding with the Netanyahu government and AIPAC against the United States government. Where's the outrage? Banking Committee Chair Johnson said on Monday that the only way the bill would be considered while diplomatic talks continue is by skipping his committee's jurisdiction and taking it straight to the Senate floor. While Johnson has a sanctions bill ready to go in case ongoing nuclear talks with Iran falter, reported Politico, he is keeping it on the back burner. He warned of the ramifications if either House passes a new sanctions bill, even if it includes a negotiating window. That makes a great deal of difference, he said. The Secretary of State has told us that it would collapse if they do the sanctions, even if it's tentative, end quote. Writing online, political analyst Jim Loeb makes an interesting point. He says, quote, what is remarkable about this list, however, is that very few of the 47, at the time co-sponsors, have chosen to publicize their support for the bill to their constituents through local media or other means. If this were a bill senators were excited about, that is something they thought they'd earn a lot of credit for and not draw a lot of heat from their voters, you'd think all the co-sponsors would be proudly touting their support, one veteran Hill Observer told Loeb. Clearly, even for the Republican co-sponsors, that doesn't seem to be the case with this bill. In other words, notes Loeb, the co-sponsors appear to be targeting a very narrow constituency, AIPAC, which is now touting their names rather than their voters back home, most of whom probably have no idea what their senator's position is or what it may take. Which raises an interesting question, Loeb continues. If the folks back home knew that their senator was supporting a bill that would make another war in the Middle East more rather than less likely, would there be an outcry as there was after Obama and AIPAC asked Congress to approve military action against Syria? Well, people don't know about it, of course, because you don't hear about it on NPR, you don't hear about it on Democracy Now!, and you don't hear about it in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. There's a blackout on this. A Reuters reporter spoke with a pro-sanctions Senate aide who told him to, quote, expect that number to keep growing over the next couple of days as folks who were out of town and staff return. We expect several Democrats to kind of cross the picket line and come on board this week, the aide said. And, of course, we've seen 3 more today. In the House, where a sanctions resolution passed in July with over 400 votes, Republican Majority Leader Eric Cantor announced Friday his intention to introduce a new bipartisan bill stating what a final nuclear deal with Iran should look like, Israel's version. Cantor tried to bring a similar resolution to the floor before the end of the year recess, but shelved those plans after House Minority Whip Steny Hoyer urged a pause in response to Obama's request. But Cantor answers to a different drummer. His loyalty is to a different country. In November 2010, after the Republicans took over the House, Cantor met privately with Benjamin Netanyahu when he was visiting in the UN in New York, an unusual thing for an American congressman to do, and he made no effort to hide it. On the contrary, a statement from Cantor's office on the one-on-one meeting said that, quote, Eric stressed that the new Republican majority will serve as a check on the administration and what it has been up until this point, one-party rule in Washington. He made clear, said the statement, that the Republican majority understands a special relationship between Israel and the United States, and that the security of each nation is reliant upon the other, end quote. At that time, Cantor also took issue with Obama administration policies in other areas, including Iran. The statement from his office noted that the congressman, quote, believes that it is time for the administration to fully and aggressively implement the Iran Sanctions Act passed by Congress earlier this year, meaning 2010. Friday, he was singing the same tune. Quote, Iran remains perhaps the most significant national security threat facing the United States and its closest allies, Cantor said without mentioning Israel. Its determined pursuit of a nuclear weapons capability and support for terrorism and instability must be stopped. It is my hope that the House, in a bipartisan manner, can express our concerns about Iran's aggression and state our position on what a comprehensive settlement of the nuclear issue should look like, end quote. Cantor's got a lot of clout, but he's no match for Senator Kirk, co-sponsor of the Senate bill, who on December 2nd received a tribute from Netanyahu by video when accepting the Henry Scoop Jackson Distinguished Person Award from the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, or JINSA, which is given annually by the underpublicized neocon organization to someone who has been outstanding in preserving the Israel-U.S. military relationship. He joins Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Joe Lieberman, and Richard Perle as past winners. Not among those is former Secretary of State Colin Powell, who blamed the Iraq War on, quote, the JINSA crowd. He was right. Here is Benjamin Netanyahu offering a tribute to Kirk and U.S.-Israel relations, followed by a short statement by the senator. I hope you have a barf bag ready.
Thank you, JINSA. Thank you for working, all of you, tirelessly for a secure Israel and a secure America. Thank you for understanding and promoting the importance of the alliance between a secure Israel and a secure America. We need that alliance more than ever in this vast expanse of land from the Atlantic Ocean through North Africa right up to the Khyber Pass. Israel stands out as a beacon of freedom, of tolerance, of democracy, of strength. I would add also of modernity, of technology, everything else that Americans value as much as Israelis. Israel stands out also in its military strength, its willingness to use that strength for its own defense and for its vital interests. I think that the alliance between Israel and the United States remains critical in the years ahead in the unfolding events, and I salute you for working towards that end. I also wish to salute my good friend, Senator Kirk. Mark, you've been a great champion of America and of Israel. You've been there in the breach time and time again. I think of you. I call you occasionally. I want you to know that I think you're a true American patriot and a wonderful friend of Israel and the Jewish people. Thank you, Mark. Thank you all.
I want to thank you all for this incredible award and recognize Admiral McRaven and all the men and women in this room who wear the uniform. Also, Chairman Royce for his strong leadership in the House of Representatives on foreign policy issues. Let me ask a question and I'll give you an answer. What is a Christian senator from the Midwest? Why is he so committed to Israel's security? The answer is because Israel shares our values. Free speech, religious freedom. If we abandon Israel, we abandon our own values. If Israel is weak, then America is weak. Let me close with some key lessons of history that I always follow in my work in the Senate. One of them is that dictators often say what they are going to do before they do it. We should believe them, not appease them. I'll keep going. When I announced for the U.S. Senate, I told you all that Israel would have no greater friend than Mark Kirk of Illinois in the Senate. I will continue working to ensure that security every day. Thank you very much for listening, and what a great award, what a great night. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
What a great night. Not a word about this in the U.S. media, of course. There's not much to say about the Israel-Palestine peace talk, peace farce that keeps earning John Kerry additional frequent fire miles, requires the likes of a Lewis Carroll or a Jonathan Swift to properly describe it. I am neither. Netanyahu tactfully delayed an announcement of new settlement plans until the departure of Kerry back to the States, and then on Monday told his Likud Knesset faction that, according to Haaretz, he has not discussed evacuating settlements during the talk. Asked, so what's left to talk about? By Knesset member Moshe Feiglin, Netanyahu replied, there's a lot of territory that still isn't settled. End quote. Now both sides are discussing the framework for future endless talks. Meanwhile, back in the United States, a frequent guest, Grant Smith, writes, at the Rush campaign to insert Stanley Fisher straight from his position leading Israel's central bank into the number two spot at the Federal Reserve, formerly held by Janet Yellen, has allowed little time to research into the appointee's career or for informed public debate about his record. Fisher's controversial attributes, writes Grant Smith, such as overhauling how U.S. aid and trade packages are delivered to Israel, have been mostly ignored. Appointing an openly dual Israeli-American citizen into the most important central bank in the world could be a watershed moment. While the doors of federal government have long swung open for Israeli lobby appointees, focusing most, if not all, their energies on advancing the interest of a foreign state, Smith writes, any who are actually Israeli dual citizens have traditionally kept that a closely guarded secret. Fisher's long-term boosters, including AIPAC, likely want to accustom Americans to openly dual citizens circulating between top roles in the U.S. and Israeli governments. A closer examination of Fisher reveals, writes Smith, that average Americans have good reason to oppose his appointment because his lifelong achievements for Israel have imposed high costs and few benefits to the United States while making peace more difficult to achieve, end quote. And you could find on the IRMEP website.org information about Stanley Fisher that you won't find anywhere else. I should add the Council on Foreign Relations, of which Fisher is a member, is thrilled about his forthcoming appointment.